Welcome to the 4 p.m. segment show, Voices from the Frontline. You're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara. This is Manuel Criollo with my co-host today, the commissioner of the Black National Question and overall cool vato, Damon Azali. And on today's show, we're bringing you some very important voices, voices that are not just commentators, voices that are not just intellectuals, but folks who are in the front lines of the organizing out there in the world. First, we're going to have Professor Armando Navarro, leader in the Coalition for Immigrant Rights and Against the Raids, and one of the leading Chicano scholars at UC Riverside. He'll be talking to us about the upcoming Saturday, October 16th, Immigrant March and Mobilization in downtown Los Angeles. And from the Bay Area, we're going to have Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, the leading indigenous analyst, and who is going to talk to us about today about the show's going to be dedicated to Indigenous Resistance Day today. And so Roxanne will be talking about the origins of the United States as a white settler nation and the conquest and genocide that was laid upon the indigenous people and how that sort of is the foundation of modern U.S. imperialism. And lastly, we're going to have in-house two producer and filmmakers of Disinformation Nation, Melody Calise and Jennifer Schofield. We'll be talking to them about their film and upcoming fundraiser at the Temple Bar, which is going to be hosted by Fidel Rodriguez on October 24th. So stay tuned. We'll be right back.
My peoples. I'm Jerry Quickly, and KPFK's Fall Fun Drive is already here. It jumps off next week, beginning on Monday night, Tuesday morning, around midnight, and running through Sunday, October 24th at midnight. We still need volunteers 24/7 for every fun drive shift. Volunteers are crucial to the success of our fun drives, and now's the time to sign up for your shift. So if you can do your part, please do contact our volunteer coordinator, Tony. You can reach him on the phone, old school styly, at 818-985-2711, extension 513. Or if you want to be all new school about it and shizzle, you can contact KPFK at kpfk.org and check out our fun drive shift schedule. You can then send an email one of the shifts or days that you can volunteer to Tony at volunteer@kpfk.org. And again, if you want to rock old school, I know some of us analog, 818-985-2711, extension 513. Sign up for a shift. Sign up for a shift. Help keep us in the green. I'm out.
Vivo contente comigo e com minha gente, pois enquanto existe Deus no céu, o urubu não come folha. Enquanto existe Deus no céu, eu vou cantando gente boa.
Minha mãe me chama,
minha mãe me chama,
Omaxi, minha mãe me chama.
Welcome back. This is Voices from the Frontlines. As we said, we're trying to connect right now with Professor Armando Navarro at UC Riverside, who's going to talk to us about this upcoming march that's going to happen this Saturday, October the 16th. It's going to happen. It's going to be assembled at Boyle Heights at the corner of Cesar Chavez and Lorena. As many of you know, the march is sort of an anniversary of a march that happened 10 years ago against Proposition 187. And also this particular march in general has a call against the raids that have happened in the Inland Empire and on throughout California this year. And so that's why we're trying to get a hold of Armando Navarro as we speak. But, you know, I think that the important question around this immigrant right march is that, you know, we're in a period right now. Last week we had Jose Bravo, and with Jose Bravo, he was talking to us about the whole week of, or whole month of activities that immigrant rights groups have been doing throughout the month. And it was just really refreshing to hear sort of their analysis that goes beyond just we should talk to white folks about immigration, sort of based on their interests, and more of a broader analysis of what's happening in the system as we speak about. In other words, you know, immigration as an outcome of U.S. policy throughout the third world. And so I think it's just really refreshing. I think what we're going to be doing, what we're going to do to switch a little bit the game plan right now, we're going to go to talk to Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz. So
I mean, just while we're waiting to get the technical difficulties off the road, I mean, I think one of the interesting questions about immigrant rights in this particular time is, you know, that this is right in the middle of the election season. And when you look at what's kind of the history of what both candidates have been talking about, immigrants' rights, they really have it. Which, you know, in terms of, if we look at how the electoral system is broken down in terms of trying to fight for a very narrow slice of the actual, you know, proposed voters or most likely voters or whatnot, I think it's just the immigrant vote is a really, really important thing.
That's right. I mean, you know, and that's what I was trying to say, that we do have an analysis of the good thing about it that's happening right now, that there has been a consolidation of an analysis of what is driving immigration and the racism that this country still has yet to confront. And I think that's going to be the important part about this conversation with Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, who's going to talk to us about the origins of this country, the origins of – this is not a country of immigrants. It's in fact, a country that was settled by outsiders, by white settlers, by white European settlers, and the impact that's had in the sort of reconstruction of the history of this country. And so we'll be right back with
– I think Roxanne's on the phone. Roxanne, are you there?
I'm here.
Welcome to Voices from the Frontlines. How are you doing today?
I'm fine. Is this Manuel?
This is Damon. I'm sitting right next to Manuel.
Okay. Yeah, I'm here.
Great. I think one of the things that we want to just kind of start off with is a lot. I mean, I think a lot of times, particularly oppressed nationality people, when they're first breaking through political consciousness, it's one of the things that does it is when they start to learn about structural white supremacy.
Right.
And I think what I think would be really good in the beginning is to get a definition so we're all kind of on the same page to know what that is. Is that people in white sheets, or is that something else that's a lot more complex?
Good. You want me to tell you now?
Yeah, so Roxanne, why don't you start off with that?
Okay. Am I on the air?
Yeah, you're on the air.
Oh, wow.
Thousands and thousands of people are listening to your every word.
Well, hello, Manuel and Damon, and I'm glad to be on the air. Yes, white supremacy is, I believe, a much more accurate term for what we're usually talking about when we say racism. Because if we say racism, it means, you know, any kind of, you know, just not liking someone because of this or that feature. And it really is something quite different than that, although that may be an aspect of it. It is the institutionalization of the sense of superior of a class that rules. Now, throughout history, throughout in Europe and different parts of the world, there have been class differences. But until the Crusades, which is interesting because it sort of makes a full circle with today, because there we are back during Crusades in Iraq. The Christian Crusaders tried to take over North Africa and what we today call the Middle East, but it's actually the Arab nation, and to conquer it. And they were unsuccessful, but there were 7 centuries of war from the time of the rise of Islam in the Arab nations. So the Castilians developed actually out of Rome, the Christian hierarchy, developed over time, a system called a test of cleanliness of blood, of limpieza de sangre. And the Inquisition was actually established to investigate cleanliness of blood. And this was the first time that there was ranking by literally by blood. It wasn't yet absolutely by color, although people in Spain who were Moors, well, Spain today is more like North Africa than it is like Europe. But there's a gradation of color as you go further south in the Iberian Peninsula. So part of it was color, but it was also job. Certain jobs were considered inferior. There was a caste system, for instance, being a scientist or a medical doctor, as many Moors were, Muslims were, this was considered unclean work. So as the Castilian crown, and especially after Castile and Aragon merged and soon became Spanish Empire, they pushed out the Moors, but those, and in 1492, a year we celebrate the same year as Columbus, they expelled all of the Jews and Muslims from the Iberian Peninsula, put them on ships, dumped them on the coast of North Africa. But many decided to convert so that they could stay in their homelands where they had lived for 900 years, 700, 800 years. I mean, they were really indigenous to the area, so they wanted to stay. But they were suspected of and were practicing their religions secretly at home. So the investigation by the Inquisition of cleanliness of blood was to make sure that the conversos and the Moriscos, they called the converted Jews conversos and the converted Muslims, Moriscos, that they were actually true Christians. So this was a part of the cargo that Columbus brought, and then Cortez and all of the other conquistadors brought to the Western Hemisphere and brought to Africa and enslaved people, was this caste system, this cleanliness of blood. So it actually has a historical origin. So when we're talking about white supremacy, we're really talking about the last 500 years plus the gradual process of developing that seven centuries before. And this then is deeply institutionalized in all of the expansion of Europe into the rest of the world. European imperialism adopted this same kind of category. And it was very, it justified, it was a means of rationalizing and justifying the enslavement of Africans, enslavement of indigenous people of the Americas, and then when that was no longer done, they were simply sold as part of the land or killed off in North America. But this is still very much with us, alive and well, and deeply embedded in all of the institutions that Europe has placed or planted really all over the planet.
You're listening to Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz. You're listening to Voices from the Front Lines. Roxanne, me and Damon had just finished rereading my time is about four times, The Grid of History, Tavils and Indians, that was published last year in the Monthly Review in the summer of last year in the Monthly Review. And in that piece, you talk about how a lot of your friends, a lot of leftist friends, aren't prepared to accept that the U.S. is imperialism at its core, as opposed to a lot of them sort of pose the question like, you know, we're a great nation, that sort of it's a deviation from that path. You know, imperialism is a deviation from sort of the ethos of this nation. Here's the question for you. How ingrained is imperialist ideology in people who live in this country? How does one undo that? If it is so ingrained.
Well, it's interesting. Those who founded the country, of course, were British themselves. I mean, they weren't Americans. Didn't have a different nationality. So it was really a split in the British Empire that existed at the time. Not an anti-colonial revolution as we try to pose it. Soon after that, soon after 1776, Haiti actually was the first anti-colonial revolution, which overthrew French imperialism and colonialism and outlawed slavery. Of course, they were the former slaves who revolted. So had that happened in the colonies, had the slaves, I mean, they were revolting, but had they succeeded in revolting and forming their own country, then that would have been anti-colonial. And if they, as they were doing, bonding with native peoples who were resisting, that's what we had in the Seminole Nation in Florida, were escaped slaves, many white indentured and formerly indentured and tenant farmers, very poor white farmers on the Georgia border, and Native Americans who led the revolts, and they fought three wars against the United States. Now, those were anti-colonial wars because the United States set itself up as an empire. The very first maps they drew in the Northwest Ordinance, which was the basis for the Constitution, really the assumed basis, was each of the new states, the former colonies, and there were only 13, you know, just hanging on to the coast. They were each granted land across the entire continent to the Pacific Ocean. So Massachusetts was granted Washington, Oregon, which they had no control of whatsoever. But you have Portland, Maine, you have Portland, Oregon, and Georgia was granted, and Virginia all the way across the Southwest. So it was drawn out. It wasn't just my interpretation of what they were doing. This was their intent. And linked to that was their intent to get rid of the Indians. You know, they had to take all of that territory, not only from other countries, like when Mexico was independent, taking half of Mexico, but also taking it from the native nations who fully controlled all of that area outside of those colonies. So the first thing they did was enter in the famous Daniel Boone trek with settlers into the Ohio Valley. So I don't think there's any doubt about it. When they were talking about freedom, they spell it out in the Declaration of Independence, where they, one of the reasons they give for breaking with the King of England is that he has prohibited their going over the Allegheny and Appalachian mountain range into Indian country to settle. And there were all kinds of squatters over there. And after the French and Indian War, the Seven Years' War, the King ordered all those settlers illegal and that they had to come back to the colonies. So this is one of the major reasons why they even revolted in the first place.
Why do you, Roxanne, why do you believe then that it's so ingrained in people, in the sense that, again, you know, I even have friends who sometimes speak about the FOs of the United States as this freedom-loving country. You know, I say primarily folks in my family, and I'm always shocked when I tell them the history, and it moves them, but it's so ingrained in folks that how do we undo that? How do we even talk to folks, and how is the best way to address people when that is just truth? I mean, this is not an interpretation. When you look at the history of the United States, or if you look at, you know, the genocidal nature it has, policy it has had toward indigenous people, how do you begin to really sort of break and destroy that sort of ideology that permeates almost all our lives?
Well, you know, it's been a lifelong pursuit of mine ever since I became conscious, which was really probably when I entered graduate school in my early 20s at UCLA and decided I would, my major would be, my specialization would be Latin American history. And even though it was taught by all white professors and except for one Chicano, Juan Gomez Quiñones, who was very important in terms of raising my consciousness, but nevertheless, even though they themselves were pretty imperialist-minded, just the fact that they gave you a little opening to see the United States from the Latin American point of view, just reading some of the original sources. And it was amazing to me because I had never taken a Latin American history course, and U.S. history, Manifest Destiny, was then just a common word, the Monroe Doctrine. But then seeing these things from how they played out in Latin America, I immediately jumped to, well, that's exactly what was going on also inside North America, that was imperialism spreading across the United, what became the United States, the North American continent, and taking half of Mexico. I believe that was the first time I learned that half of Mexico was taken, as a matter of fact. So it's odd that a college graduate, you know, has to actually take a course in Latin American history to even find out that fact. Actually, not very many people register or allow into their consciousness that half of Mexico was taken, much less that the Indian nations, you know, filled the whole continent, not just a few either noble savages or bad savages running around in the forest somewhere, that they had farms, they had towns, they had monuments, and that these were all obliterated. It's really difficult, and sometimes I get quite hopeless because I struggle with students, you know, on a small scale. Every class I've ever had, I believe I've been able to get that understanding through to maybe 30 individuals, you know, but it never seems like enough. And it's particularly despairing, you know, that so many of my progressive friends, you know, like Howard Zinn or Noam Chomsky, they will say, oh, yes, yes, but they don't then talk about it in their actual presentations. And mostly people want to date U.S. imperialism from 1898 when Cuba and the Philippines were taken and Puerto Rico, the former Spanish territories, say that was a moment in time. And then the national security state after 1945, after World War II and the establishment of the CIA. But there was no national security state or CIA when the United States intervened and occupied Nicaragua and Haiti and Cuba, you know, in the late 19th and early 20th century, had Sandino killed, Raimundo Martí, any kind of resistance that existed. This was all before the national security state, and then all of the Indian wars. And I think one thing to tell people is they just think of the Marine Anthem, from the homes of the Montezuma to the shores of Tripoli.
The first time I heard that, I think it was on a Bugs Bunny cartoon.
Yeah. Well, the Montezuma, that was Mexico, but what's this Tripoli about? Well, that's what the Marines were created for in 1808. Was to go to the Barbary Coast, where the barbarians were, right? That is North Africa, and to open free trade there and not have to, you know, respect the sovereignty of the peoples. In fact, most of those peoples were people who had been expelled from Spain in 1492. So they were pretty pretty well aware of imperialism by then, and they fought. And so this was the first time the Marines, they were invented, and that was their first invasion of the North African coast. So that's where Tripoli is. And it was actually what is today, not Tripoli, Libya, but Tripoli, Lebanon, was the place that was occupied. So that goes back to 1806, you know, during Jefferson's term. And there's so much in his writings and the literature of the time that we should just annex those countries, you know, and the United States had learned from Britain that whenever possible, indirect imperialism is better than settler colonialism because it's so costly and there are constant rebellions. So creating a, and Latin America is called a cacique class, but a comprador, the Africans call it a comprador class, or the Raj like in India. And that's what the United States had received all of that knowledge of how to create an empire. So they didn't start from scratch. You know, they started from their beginning, but they carried on. They took over a part of the British Empire and then carried on with those institutions and means. And I think people get into the moral argument and say, oh, well, okay, the United States did some bad things, but there's bad and good. But that's not the point. It's like, you know, don't call it bad or good. Just say what it is and let people make up their minds, you know, about what that has to do with what we're doing in the United States today. And we keep being surprised. Well, that was out of character for the United States. Vietnam was out of character. Then what, the invasion of Grenada, the first Gulf War, these are all exceptions to the rule rather than a pattern that's very clear.
Well, in terms of what you were saying is call it like what it is, based on what you wrote in the essay, I mean, there's a lot of stuff in terms of it being interwoven as kind of religion helps overlay and helps kind of imperialism developed. And in terms of, I'm just thinking about what the U.S.'s role in the Middle East and how the history of it has been kind of attacking left secular groups and then bolstering up and supporting kind of the religious fundamentalists because they seem to think that they're easier to deal with. One of the examples that I was trying to figure out in relation to what you're writing is in Palestine. A lot of it is painted as this kind of, you know, Muslim versus kind of Jewish question. But really what the call it like it is basically just like what happened in the U.S., settlers coming in, taking land, taking resources, and then it's kind of painted and overlaid as this kind of religious dichotomy. Same thing in Ireland, and you write about that in your essay. It's this kind of Protestant Catholic thing, but really the underlying thing is really about just taking stuff. So I was just wondering if you can kind of just expand on that idea.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I think the United States saw the well, I certainly was familiar with it because I worked in the 70s and early 80s with the Afro-Asian People's Solidarity organization that was based in Cairo, and they taught me to do UN lobbying work, which I wanted to do for indigenous peoples. But I learned so much from the inside. There were real revolutions going on. Of course, the Palestinians that had just recently become the Palestine Liberation Organization was the really, I don't like to use the word vanguard anymore, but the, you know, the ideological and the strongest of the revolutionary movement was a guidance for all the others. And they were leftists, and they were, I mean, some were practicing Muslims, many were Christian born, most were not religious, you know, necessarily at all. They certainly were not promoting the expansion of religion. And it was with the Iranian Revolution, I think the U.S. had a big role in placing Homani in the religious right, because there was such a strong workers' movement and women's movement in Iran, and that got completely crushed by the imposition of a religious order. Well, they still tried to destroy it by, of course, arming Saddam Hussein, who was well-loved by the United States because he killed communists. He killed them in the square. A number of friends of mine were were beheaded in the public square in Baghdad in 1980. Saddam Hussein was beloved by, you know, the United States government because he...
Roxanne, I don't want to interrupt your phone, but just in terms of your phone, there's a little bit of noise, so maybe if you can hold it slightly farther away from your mouth.
Is that better?
Yeah.
Okay. So, yes, the Israel, you know, the establishment of Israel was exactly based on United States, the conceptualization and the framework of an enclave in Indian country, as they call enemy territory in U.S. jargon. And it was meant to be an enclave, a sort of like a fort that the army would set up in Indian country to then spread out from. And it's a very important struggle for us to know more about, because it does reflect, because you can look at it and break it down. I think also the apartheid government of South Africa, you can look at and break down and see a reflection of United States historically. And this is, and also Northern Ireland, the Scots Irish settlers planted right in the middle of the indigenous Irish. And so the religion then becomes a definition and really a smokescreen for what's actually going on. And in the Arab world, of course, the oil under the ground is just the key factor. I think this image that I actually saw live on television of the U.S. military going in and going straight to the oil ministry and to all the wells to protect them, but they didn't even try to find weapons of mass destruction. They knew they weren't there. They didn't try to protect the museums or anything. It was just oil. It was so clear. You know, it was there on television. I don't know how people miss it. You know, you want to believe, I mean, nationalism, the type of nationalism that exists in the United States is one we're instilled with, and every immigrant coming in, I don't know if you've ever looked at the materials that immigrants have to study and pass tests on to become citizens.
Well, actually, one's really interesting, just kind of side note here. We were doing some voter registration stuff at the Naturalization Service, where there's like, you know, 8,000 people being naturalized, and they are all given flags. They all see a speech of George Bush, you know, now you're an American, you know, join in the apple pie. And when we're doing actually the registering, about half of the people registered as Republicans. And
yeah.
I think that's directly related on all the kind of hype and flag waving and, you know, that's happening right there. So that's a
well, and they want to be safe, you know. I mean, they think they have to do everything just correctly, or else they'll end up in detention or expelled. Even citizenship is no longer a protection, you know, for many people who immigrate from the Arab world. But, yeah, they are brainwashed. And then here they've cut off their lives. They've come to another country. They want to believe, you know, so that's been the strategy of immigration. Is that's why they don't want Mexican workers to be legalized or any poor people, but it's really a brain drain from other countries. And then, you know, it's such a big step for those people. They're then cultivated with just intact, so they feel no responsibility for U.S. history or anything that was done. I don't know how many times I hear, well, my parents weren't even here yet when all those things happened. You know,
why are you trying to take my stuff?
Yeah, but nevertheless, here you are enjoying the bounty of genocide and theft, and, you know, you have to take responsibility for it. That should be a part of citizenship, is taking responsibility for all the crimes the U.S. government has committed. And that's not encouraged at all. All you have to take responsibility for is being a good, obedient, patriotic citizen.
I mean, I think that's the, you know, the crazy contradiction, I think, for many oppressed people in this country and a lot of people of color, is that on one hand, you know, even though at the core of much of the exploitation and oppression people face has a material basis, in other words, that the system is trying to extract more from these people, at this, you know, there's that sort of overlay in that racism and the form of oppression sometimes doesn't even have a material wealth. In other words, when they hang someone in the South or in Arizona, you know, it wasn't just like that person is a possible person who's taking my job. It's a deep-seated hatredness that people have been taught.
Right.
And on the other hand, though, you know, many people also benefit from living inside the United States. And, I mean, even oppressed people benefit from living inside the United States. So there's that huge contradiction that's there. But I think ultimately for, I think a lot of, if you think about the history of blacks, the history of Chicanos, history of indigenous peoples, and a lot of API folks, there is this question that you will never be accepted as a full U.S. citizen. It's been proven throughout history that your relationship to the U.S. is almost conditional. You know, like, today you're one of us and tomorrow you're not. And, I mean, I know in your essay you talked a lot about how people were forced to be converted. How do you see that? I mean, where do we see ourselves in 50 years if that is sort of the mode of operation that you will always have ultimately a conditional relationship, and sort of where do we head it? If that's true, then what do we do?
Well, you know, they've learned a lot, the powers that be and all the think tanks and everything, from the uprisings of the 50s and 60s, the civil rights movement, and then the renewal of Native resistance and Chicano resistance and Puerto Rican. And women, you know, that a caste system that discriminates is no longer going to work, you know, and what they never want is for all these people to get together as oppressed workers or, you know, oppressed economically. And so I think now, I mean, the Republican Party has really constructed itself, and it is, it's only gotten up to about 12% of its membership is people of color, but they're putting most of their resources into a new definition of whiteness, which is pure patriotism, and with several tests of, you know, totally unrestricted free trade, that is no government services for anything. And a lot of people fall in love with that idea of I am my own master and I can do it, and if I don't, then I'm, you know, a failure. So it separates people who are a little bit better off within each of the oppressed groups, so that they are then there to condemn and hold down the others, whereas a generation ago, you had those same people as important leaders like Stokely Carmichael and all. I mean, they didn't change, but the new batch, you know, they have been recruited for this. And of course, throughout the world, the whole revolutionary movement has been, has been crushed, and something new is trying to get born everywhere. And it's going, you know, it's very different than before. But here I think we haven't quite figured out, you know, how to resist, because we are, I mean, if you see all the things they do to other people in the world, we're right here under their thumb all the time getting brainwashed and, you know, supposedly are a part of this country, and it can be very numbing, you know, and I think it's going to take really getting serious in terms of, I don't mean grim, you know, or sad or something, but serious about thinking things through and not just how to this and how to that, how to have a demonstration, how to have, anti-racist workshop. These things are all important, but to also go beyond that and really try to figure out what we're dealing with, because you have to know your enemy to be able to figure out how you overcome it, you know, and I think that's, if it worked to just, the thing that people tell me is why they don't tell, they claim they know the truth about the United States, why they don't, are not more open about telling us is it turns people off. Well, if you never try it, you don't really know if it turns people off, you know, and maybe you haven't learned it well enough yourself to tell it so that it makes sense, you know, and isn't full of contradictions. But even so, if it turns people off, it still is clear. It's not as if, you know, lefties are turning a lot of people on right now. It's quite like we're going to lose this mass base, you know, that we have. And I think it's just time to really try telling the absolute truth and telling it calmly. And, you know, like Chomsky does about the rest of the world, but he doesn't know much about, you know, inside the United States, I think. He doesn't. I think for myself, coming from a combination of, you know, a Native American on my mother's side and the old settler class, the Skasari settler class that I call the foot soldiers of empire on the other side, I just feel like, you know, that we are so raised in that among those people, like rural Southerners, and I was raised in rural Oklahoma, taking these things for granted. But if you bring these things up to consciousness, it is really very clear, you know, that these people are still, this class of people, this group of people, the descendants of the old settlers, are still the people that rule this country and that populate the Republican Party and all. And I think we have to steal their children. This is, you know, my nieces and nephews and grandchildren. I do a lot of work back in Oklahoma, and there is a movement of very brave young people, you know, who are really, really learning. But in the urban areas, we have to get in touch with that, what this country is really about. It's hard to even go out in those areas, you know, the bigotry and the fundamentalism and all. And I grew up with all that, you know, but it has to be defeated, you know, or because it's still the lifeline, you know, for carrying on really white supremacist practices. But they're doing it now without the exterior, you know, the most obvious kinds of discrimination. I mean, does anyone really care? Or do many people really care about warehousing of, you know, young black males? Mm. I mean, it's, you know, there's a huge prison, a big prison movement, but it's maybe, you know, like 1% of the people who are even aware of what's going on. It's just the
and
new,
then we have right now in Los Angeles County a measure that's basically going out that's trying to increase probably actually raise about $500 million a year. This is Measure A, to actually put more cops on the streets and open up two county jails. So it's right there what you're talking about.
Yeah.
So I wanted to thank Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz for joining us today. You're listening to KPFK 90.7 in Los Angeles, 98.7 in Santa Barbara. And we'll be right back talking to two filmmakers that made a film called Disinformation Nation. And they're going to be they're being helped out by KPFK's own Fidel Rodriguez. So we'll be right back right after this break.
Señor de maíz, el cielo te está cuidando. Ya.